You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest takes us on a tour of utopian communities from the American past.
First, when was the last time you found yourself staring at the little triangle on the bottom of a plastic container to figure out how to recycle it? Well, it may come as a surprise that the System of Numbers, which is today a global recycling standard, originated here in Wisconsin.
In a new children's book, our guest, Elise Moser, tells the story of Wisconsinite Millie Zanto, who kickstarted plastic recycling in the 70s after noticing tons of reusable garbage dumped into the overflowing landfill in her town, Sauk City.
Writer Elise Moser joins us in studio now. Her book is called What Millie Did, The Remarkable Pioneer of Plastics Recycling. Elise, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, this is not someone that I had ever heard of and a story I'd never heard before. How did you find out about her?
I found out about her kind of by accident. I went to an environmental information day in Sauk City, and somebody mentioned that the woman who invented the recycling symbol was from Sauk City. In fact, she, as you said, invented the system of numbers inside the triangle, but close enough. And I was kind of new to the area, and I thought, well, everyone must know this. I just don't know because I'm the new girl. But when I asked around, I found out that nobody knew, and I thought everybody should know.
And so you've told her story in a children's book. Why a children's book in particular?
Because my first thought really was kids should know a woman did this. I was surprised. First of all, it never occurred to me somebody had to invent that because I just never thought about it. But then I thought, you know, women's accomplishments are often not as visible as they should be, and especially in the area of science, technology. And this was a big thing. I thought boys and girls should grow up knowing women do these things.
And it sounds as though she got the little first germ of an idea on a trip to Japan. You write in the book that she was there as a volunteer sort of ambassador for the International Crane Foundation, which in itself sounds like a cool story. But what did she see in Japan?
She stepped out of the place where she was staying every morning, and there were little bundles on the curb. And every day the bundles were different. And she started to realize day after day that what she was seeing was little bundles of recyclable materials, but separated by type. And that's when she realized that it was recycling, and it made an impression on her.
So she started working on a project to recycle and come up with a system. And at some point along, of course, she had to buy an industrial grinder. Now, here's Millie. Here's her voice in a 2012 interview describing picking up this giant grinder from a factory in Chicago.
They just died laughing when they saw us. That made their day. Loading that plastic grinder in the back of the truck, it weighed a ton. We were both so busy. When we got into it, we went all the way. I mean, we did everything.
That was 6 days a week.
Right. And then if we had a good March wind, it was 7 days a week because I chased the stuff all the way up the highway as it blew away.
Incredible story there about purchasing that first grinder. Sounds like people were laughing at Millie and her friend. And it's a funny story, but it's also remarkable because there was a lot of sacrifice involved in what they did to get that grinder.
Yes.
What happened?
They needed $5,000 and they didn't have it. So Millie convinced her friend, who you heard in that clip, Jenny Ale, who still lives in now Prairie du Sac. They cashed in their life insurance policies to get the money. Millie later said, well, we knew we didn't need the money. We didn't need the life insurance right away, but we needed the money right away. And so they cashed it in.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Millie Zanto from Wisconsin, from Sauk City, and her pioneering efforts in plastics recycling here in the United States. We're talking to Elise Moser, who has a new book out about her, a children's book. And you got to meet Millie before she passed away, but not very long before she passed away.
Nope. It was a real amazing fluke. I went to, I had been looking for her and I couldn't find her, because I realized later that people kind of disappear when they go into a nursing home. There are no traces anymore out in the world. And I found her by accident. I was going to visit another friend, and she was there, and I knocked on her door and introduced myself, and I said, can I come back one day and interview you? And she said, well, why don't we just do it right now? And I found out later that her illness was advancing, and that may have been her last lucid day.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And did she, at that point, have a sense of sort of the history and the magnitude of what she'd done, what she'd created?
I think she did. For a long time after she stopped being actively involved in the recycling business, she was invited to come visit communities all over the United States and much further afield, China, Mexico, to help other people set up their recycling systems. So she knew that what she had done had triggered a worldwide, the worldwide capacity to recycle plastics.
I think now we think of recycling, oh, it's just one of those household chores. It's like taking out the garbage or doing the dishes. Can you talk about, there's the numbers and the other things that she did, that she created, that are now just part of the background routine for us now?
Well, the main thing is the system of numbers. They're called resin codes. And so when we think of plastic, we think of it as if it's just one thing. We only have the one word for it in the vernacular. But in fact, plastics are many different kinds of things. Chemically, they're different from each other, and you can't melt them together, which was why nobody had been recycling plastics before Millie figured out an easy way to separate them. And so it's that system of numbers. I mean, Millie figured out an entire system. She figured out it has to be sustainable from a financial point of view. She convinced somebody to figure out how to manufacture things out of the recycled plastic. She figured out how to make the system work from one end to the other. But it was the numbers, the system of resin codes that made it possible globally.
And she also discovered that you couldn't create things like this, start a movement in a vacuum. It sounds like she partnered with schools and local businesses and got everybody sort of on board and tried not to step on toes. What was her relationship with the community like?
Well, this whole thing happened because she was so connected to her community, and she really activated the community around her to be engaged with this. When she first started, she knew she wanted to collect not only plastics, but also paper and aluminum. But she knew that there were Boy Scouts in Sauk City who were collecting newspapers for recycling, and so they would not collect newspapers in places where they were in competition with the kids. There were kids also who were collecting aluminum, and they collected enough to buy a microscope for their school. So Millie was careful. She was more interested in making the whole idea work than in succeeding in having, you know, the most.
And Millie passed away a couple years ago. You shared with us a picture you took of a bench that's in downtown Sauk City that commemorates her life and her work. Oh, we've got that picture, by the way, on the Central Times show page on WPR.org. Can you tell us about the quote that's inscribed on it? Waste is not waste until it is wasted.
Right. That was one of many pithy sayings Millie had. That was the root of her philosophy. You know, she grew up during the Depression. She grew up on a farm in Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl years. When she was a kid, they made or grew almost every single thing that they used or consumed. And so she understood that it's a waste if you throw something away. But just because it doesn't do what it was originally meant to do, if you can find a way to reuse it or recycle it, it's not wasted.
She sounds like an incredible person. And we're going to give Millie the last word. Here she is from that same interview in 2012, 2 years before she died.
My folks always said, use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without.
The voice of Millie Zanto. And Elise, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Elise Moser, the author of What Millie Did, the remarkable pioneer of plastics recycling. Almost 200 years ago, a series of unique experiments kicked off in the United States. People form communities in states all over the country trying to create real-life utopias where people lived in harmony with nature, with God, or with each other. Famous communities included New Harmony in Indiana, the Shaker Village in Pleasant Hill, Kentucky, and the anarchist villages in Ohio and Long Island.
Our next guest explored the history of those communities, and then he got in a truck, and he went on a 2,300-mile tour of the historic sites. He says we can learn a lot about our nation from these 19th century utopias. Author Eric Reese joins us now. His new book is called Utopia Drive, A Road Trip Through America's Most Radical Idea. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Eric, what led you to take this road trip to the sites of these utopian communities from a couple centuries ago?
I think it was just, I've been for many years just really impressed by just the radical idealism that these visionaries embodied. And so I've been collecting documentation and archives about these different communities for about two decades. And I think I just sort of hit this point a couple years ago where I thought, you know, we have these such seemingly insurmountable problems of income inequality and environmental problems that I just thought, you know, it's time to sort of embrace something optimistic and sort of solution-focused.
And you write that some of these settlements were motivated by religion, some for secular reasons, some by a early forming socialist ideology, a lot of them a combination, all of the above. Do you see a common theme that runs through all of them?
Yeah, there's definitely, you see a lot of the same things. I mean, you certainly see a kind of, you know, across-the-board egalitarianism that, you know, transcended racial lines and gender lines. You really see just a lot of self-sufficiency within the communities. They were nonviolent. They were non-exploitive. They all had their own alternative economic systems. They of course, emphasized sharing to a huge degree. So even though, you know, the ones that were religious sort of based that on the passage in the book of Acts that says the first Christians, you know, shared all things in common. And then the ones that were secular sort of went back to these early roots of socialism that Robert Owen brought to the country. So they came at it from very different ways. But when they actually got together, as they sometimes did, they found that they had a whole lot in common.
Now, as you went on this tour, and you just hit kind of the eastern half of the country on this, but what kind of things can we still see from their communities?
Well, the Shakers at Pleasant Hill, they've really preserved the community in ways that are, you know, you look at the way the community is laid out and you realize that, you know, people move from work to church to pleasure to dancing to eating, you know, all within sort of a 10-minute walk. So, you know, these kinds of planned communities that we're seeing pop up, you know, in the country today, you know, they very much sort of believe in that kind of approach. And then I just, you know, you would see just sometimes it was just, you know, there was just kind of the ruins of a community that was left behind. But I sort of was interpreting these ruins as these dream images, these images of redemption, of things that we could still sort of salvage and use as inspirations in a way of, you know, to think about the future.
Talking to author Eric Reese about his new book, it's called Utopia Drive, A Road Trip Through America's Most Radical Idea, looking at these utopian communities, a lot of them in the early to mid-1800s. This era kind of ended, you write, Eric, with the outbreak of the Civil War, leading up to the Civil War era. Why did this great flowering, and there were a lot of these communities, you write, why did this experiment kind of taper off, come to an end for a while?
I think the story of the Civil War was just such a larger myth-making story, the idea that, you know, we need to unite this nation. We don't need to be, you know, splintering off into a thousand different little communities. I think that proved to be such a powerful narrative that, you know, the country really wanted to embrace that. And then you had the industrialism that the Civil War brought on. And so, for instance, the seed business that the Shakers had started, you know, that sort of went out of business. And so I think a lot of these sort of decentralized economies found it harder and harder to compete in the than the post-Civil War world.
Eric, if you'll excuse me for getting into the racier side of things here, the attitudes towards sex in these communities, they really ran the gamut. You mentioned the Shaker village. No sex at all. They did not want to have children. They adopted children, as I understand it, to try to keep alive. On the other end, there were some that advocated free love, ending, they viewed marriage, I think, as a kind of property. They didn't want property.
Right.
So anything went, I guess. Talk about that range of attitudes.
Well, yeah, I was trying to explain to my wife, you know, the range of these things, and her comment was, so if a woman founds the community, they don't have any sex, and if a man founds the community, they have all the sex they want. So, I mean, it definitely runs the gamut. My mother Ann Lee, who started the Shakers, she had come out of a crushing marriage, and she saw marriage as this way of oppressing women. The New Harmony people felt the same way. They felt like, you know, when a woman in Indiana got married, she, you know, basically lost her rights as a citizen or as a property holder. And then up in Oneida, New York, they invented this sort of loose interpretation of the Bible to say that, you know, basically there was no sin in the world, and so because of the second coming, and therefore you can basically do what you want in the sexual arena.
Now, all of these utopian communities pretty much ended for one reason or another, and I think it would be easy to look back and call them failures. I think other people have. You don't. You see them as successes in the sense that they helped shape what happened later in America, or even at the time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's a big myth that they were failures, but the Shakers lasted here in Kentucky for 100 years. The Oneidans, they lasted for 50 years, and then they just turned into a joint stock company that, of course, is famous for their silverware. So I think we as a country, we want to think that they failed because that's a way of reinforcing the status quo. But then if you look back and you think, you know, these people had some really radical ideas about how to organize life in America in a way that's, you know, very different from the way it is now, that, you know, you can look back and say, well, wait a minute, you know, given the financial collapse of 2008, you know, maybe we shouldn't be so quick to reject these ideas. Maybe there's things here that we could salvage and use and be inspired by.
And you say you're taking a road trip through America's most radical idea. What exactly was the radical idea? Is it that we, as Americans, we can build things, we can make our communities better in ways that the old world couldn't?
I think so. I think it's the idea that it doesn't have to. I think we as Americans, you know, we sort of, there's an inevitability to the way, you know, we look at the world, and we think, well, this is the way it is, so this is the way it just, you know, is going to be. And they looked at the world, especially after the panic of 1837, and they said, no, it doesn't have to be this way. We can radically reorganize communities so that there's no racism, there's no sexism, there's no economic inequality, there's no violence. And they did it, and in a lot of very different ways, they were successful.
Eric, this is a history book in a way, and in a way, you're not writing a history book. Can you talk about what we can learn from this world of intentional communities, utopian communities, now in 2016?
I was trying to, tell this intellectual history of this movement, and then I was also trying to bring it into the present and say, you know, these communities, they represent models that we can embrace. And that's why I looked at some contemporary examples, like, for instance, communities in Massachusetts where they've started using their own local currency as a way to sort of, you know, circumvent the financial system. And so I think there's a lot of things like that you can draw from the 19th century utopian communities. And you can look at the ones that are still in existence now, and you can look at them and say, wow, you know, these people are, you know, they are completely egalitarian. It's profit sharing, and it's something that still can be a useful way of thinking about what America could be moving forward.
And you quoted, I think it was Milton Friedman saying, you know, part of the job of the economist is to have alternative models so, you know, when what we're doing now goes wrong, we can reach into that toolkit. That's what you see these utopian communities of the past and present as. They're keeping a toolkit alive so if, you know, consumer society, whatever we want to call it, goes off the rails, we've got other people working on other stuff, other ideas.
That's right. I mean, I don't quote Milton Friedman a lot, but I thought that was incredibly instructive. That idea that you know these blueprints they still exist and they're still relevant.
And Eric, having done the work you've done, the road trip, the research, talking to modern communities like this, would you want to live in something like this? Would you want to start the Reesian community out in the wild somewhere?
Well, I live out in the wild. One of the points I make in my book is that there's a utopia of solidarity and there's a utopia of solitude. And the utopia of solidarity are these great visionary collectivists who come together around these ideas of sharing. And then there's a utopia of solitude, like Henry David Thoreau's the most famous example in this country, of somebody who, you know, tries to create that sort of self-reliance in a very solitary way. So I realized when I visited the contemporary communities that are still going that I probably wouldn't be a great member. I'm a little too introverted and not enough of a joiner, I think, to really belong to a community like that. So I think I realize that I trend a little more towards the utopia of solitude.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Eric Reese. He's the author of the new book, Utopia Drive, A Road Trip Through America's Most Radical Idea.
As we get closer to the general election in November, we're taking a look at what the candidates will have to do to win Wisconsin.
While Wisconsin's status as a battleground state varies, both candidates have been pursuing plans in the state that indicate that neither campaign is going to take chances, including Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, who has sent surrogates, and her running mate Tim Kaine to campaign here in Wisconsin.
But what will Clinton have to do to secure the most votes in the state, and what issues concern Wisconsinites the most?
We want to hear from you. What do you think of Hillary Clinton's chances in Wisconsin in November? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lily Gorin joins us now. She's a professor of political science and global affairs at Carroll University in Waukesha, and she's the author of the book Women and the White House and also Mad Men in Politics. She joined us last week to talk about GOP nominee Donald Trump's chances in Wisconsin, and now we turn to Hillary Clinton. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on again.
Well, where does Hillary Clinton stand in Wisconsin right now?
Well, we haven't had really recent polls out of Marquette, but the last polls have indicated that she was ahead in the state. So at the moment, she's leading in the polls in Wisconsin.
Now, Hillary Clinton lost the Wisconsin primary in March to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. What happened there, and what might it portend for her strength here going forward?
Well, I mean, what was interesting about Wisconsin in the primary is both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin to their rivals during the primaries. And so both of them are having to make up for the fact that they, you know, they didn't have the most primary voters come out and support them during the primaries. And so we talked about this a little bit last week with Donald Trump. And so Hillary Clinton is going to have to appeal to and campaign to a lot of the Bernie Sanders supporters who were very vocal and very engaged during the primary season and helped Bernie Sanders to carry Wisconsin during the primary. And that's one of the reasons that you've seen Tim Kaine here. And you also, you know, originally Hillary Clinton was supposed to have her first, I think, campaign outing with President Obama after he formally endorsed her at the end of the campaign season or primary season here in Wisconsin. But then there there was a terrorist event, and so they canceled that initial sort of campaign event that was back, I think it was in May or June.
And there was that big effort at the Democratic National Convention to convince Bernie Sanders that they could vote for Hillary Clinton, that she would reflect their needs and address the same issues, at least some of them, that Bernie Sanders would be looking at. How effective was that, do you think? And especially here in Wisconsin, have you heard anything about how Bernie Sanders supporters have sorted themselves post-convention?
I haven't really seen much data on that. And this is some of the same issues that we were talking about last week with regard to Donald Trump courting the Ted Cruz voters. Hillary Clinton has to make a pitch specifically in places like Wisconsin, where she didn't carry the state, to bring over the enthusiastic supporters of people like Bernie Sanders to her campaign. And I think probably, polls moving forward will be able to see, again, how her support is and whether or not that support is moving in her direction. A lot of the folks who were polled or asked during the Democratic convention whether or not that they would support Hillary Clinton if they had been Sanders supporters, I think it was over 60 or 70% of the Sanders supporters who were asked said that they would, in fact, support Hillary Clinton. So I'm assuming that a lot of the reason why she's probably currently somewhat ahead in Wisconsin is because there are Sanders supporters who have said, yes, that they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Are there particular groups, I should say, that Hillary Clinton may have trouble with when you look at the polls? I'm thinking about in particular white men that she might need to do some outreach toward.
The polls have indicated that white men, particularly white men without a college education, are, I believe, her weakest group of supporters. And so outreach to those groups in particular are ones where she should be focusing attention. At the same time, Hillary Clinton probably needs to be focusing attention as well on suburban white female voters in large measure, because they seem to be swing voters and ones who are deciding between voting for Hillary Clinton and voting for Donald Trump. They decided between, say, voting for Romney and Obama in 2012. And that may be a group of people who may be more easily sort of persuaded, or they may be more open to listening to arguments from Hillary Clinton.
So if she's got to reach out to suburban women voters, what does she need to say? What does that group want to hear, do you think?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about the economy. Long political science research has indicated that women voters have a tendency to sort of, know how much money they have in their purse and how much things cost at the grocery store. And as a result of that, if there's some concern about the economy, they're sort of really at the apex of that concern. And so we've seen, a lot of different things coming forward in terms of what voters are concerned about with regard to this election. And one of them is economics. Another, obviously, is this question of security with regard to protecting the United States from terrorist attacks and, repelling terrorism in general, both domestically and, in other parts of the world. And so those tend to be the issues that have been floating to the top when voters are asked, what is your biggest concern?
We're talking with Carroll University's Lily Gorin. She's a political science and global studies professor there. And we're taking a look at what Hillary Clinton will have to do if she wants to win in November. We did the same conversation with Lily Gorin last week, looking at what Donald Trump will need to do if he wants to succeed in Wisconsin. And Lily, you said she does need to make Wisconsin a priority, reach out to some of these former Sanders voters, to suburban women. Hillary Clinton hasn't been in the state a lot. There was that planned visit.
Right.
In June, but then there was that Pulse nightclub shooting
right.
on June 13th, and so she canceled that visit with President Obama, and she hasn't been very present here. Do you think that's going to hurt her in any way?
Well, I mean, again, we're not even in the sort of the post Labor Day period of the election when things really ratchet up, and she has been going to some of the other states that are also in play, but I expect that we'll probably see Hillary Clinton, and we'll likely also see a number of high profile surrogates as well after Labor Day, probably President Obama and or Michelle Obama, and I know that in the past as well we have seen seen Bill Clinton has come. He campaigned for President Obama when Obama was running for re-election. So I expect not only that Hillary Clinton will come and campaign in Wisconsin, and she did come through a number of times before the primary as well. And of course, we had the debate here during the primary season. But I assume that she will be back.
And one group that seems to be another high-stakes group for her would be registered independents. There has been some movement there as well nationally showing that the gap is closing between registered independents who say they would support Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, and it used to be she had a bigger lead than she has now. Should she be doing some groundwork there?
Well, I think, you know, the independent voters are, again, ones who are open to persuasion. And so reaching out to sort of persuadable voters or undecided voters are often the same ways that you would reach out to registered independent voters, because they're ones that are not necessarily used to voting one particular party or another, and therefore they are more open to, you know, hearing an argument and considering two candidates and not necessarily voting a straight party ticket, as it were.
We're talking right now with Lily Gorin, talking about what Hillary Clinton would need to do to win in Wisconsin come November. Lily is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha, and she's also the author of Women and the White House.
We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What issues are you most concerned about in this upcoming election? Do you think Hillary Clinton can help resolve those issues? Are you on the fence? Are you a Bernie Sanders supporter? Are you going to vote now for Hillary Clinton? Do you consider yourself an independent? Which way are you thinking of going? Are you Republican, thinking of maybe voting for Hillary Clinton? We've seen some of that around the country. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about what Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton would need to do to hold on to her current lead in Wisconsin when it comes to actual voting time in November. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think Hillary Clinton will win Wisconsin? Do you think she should win Wisconsin? Who are you going to vote for? Are you surprised that you're thinking of voting for or against particular candidates this time around? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're one of those Bernie Sanders supporters we were hearing about earlier, where are you going in November? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lily Gorin is our guest right now. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. And she's also the author of Women and the White House. We're going to take our first caller now. We've got Aaron joining us in Sturgeon Bay. Aaron, hi.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. My comment is I've been a lifelong Democrat, born in a Democratic family. In fact, I tried to convince my grandmother to run for president. She was a big DFLer in Minnesota.
And she didn't take you up on that, huh?
And no, she didn't, unfortunately. But she was very active, and pictures of her with Hubert Humphrey and all the big dignitaries in Minnesota politics. But I just want to say that I think that people are ready for a female president. People want, I think the divine feminine is something very important, and we need to have that. But I just don't think that Hillary Clinton is the one. I'm voting for Andrew DiBiasio.
All right. What is it about Hillary Clinton? You said she's not the one. What is it about her that is making you feel that like you're not going to vote for her?
Well, I really wanted to, and I actually was rooting for her last time she was running. But when a female motorcycle officer died in one of her motorcades, and she didn't even hardly acknowledge it. It made me think that she was heartless. But also, she hasn't really accomplished anything. She only wrote three bills, like renaming a post office when she was senator. I just don't think that she has the qualifications. And then there's all of the scandals that seem to be just increasing around her.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the thoughts there. And it sounds as though you use the word qualifications, but I think in general, the consensus is that she's qualified. It sounds like what you're getting at, Aaron, is more questions of character. And that seems to be the thing that's dogging her. Lily, do you see those questions that Aaron raised being a sticking issue here in Wisconsin and beyond?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the issues that Clinton has faced, you know, all along in this, in both her runs for president, that there, you know, there has been the questions about, you know, her relationship recently with regard to these emails and the Clinton Foundation issues that have been coming up in news stories in the last couple of weeks. And there's a lot of this concern with regard to, you know, trustworthiness. And this is one of the reasons why you see that Hillary Clinton, even as the nominee for the Democratic Party, has very high negative appeal in the country. And so she does have this reputation that's dogging her both in Wisconsin and nationally with regard to whether or not people trust her.
Aaron, thanks so much for the call. We're going to move next to Brandon joining us in Oshkosh. Brandon, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think it would be smart for Hillary to tap in to the hatred in Wisconsin towards Scott Walker and, I guess, the Republican Party in general. I mean, if she can reach out to the state workers that were affected by Act 10 and ex-state workers, you know, people that have left state service, you know, those people are furious with the Republican Party and Scott Walker. So thank you for my call.
Okay, thanks, Brandon. Is there something to that, Lily? Should Hillary Clinton align herself with the former Act 10 protesters and the animosity that some people feel toward Scott Walker and other people who were active during Act 10?
Well, I mean, I think this, you know, this sort of breaks down along some of the traditional party lines. And certainly in Wisconsin, we do have, you know, this sort of really polarizing political situation that's coming out of some of the protests and the Act 10 choices and so forth. But I think that Hillary is also trying to campaign specifically against Donald Trump, and some of the speeches she's made are, you know, to some degree interesting efforts to recruit Republicans to feel okay voting for her for president. And the speech she made last week with regard to, you know, sort of the alt-right and some of the neo-Nazi movements that are being integrated into the Trump campaign or that have supported, you know, openly supported Trump. She's sort of trying to make an argument that, you know, Republicans who aren't feeling comfortable with Trump should feel comfortable voting for her. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a interesting partisan approach. And, you know, again, it's also potentially about splitting tickets. And so you vote for Hillary Clinton at the top of the ticket, and then, you know, you might vote down ballot for some of the Republicans if you're a Republican. And so I think that sort of that argument broadly is what she's making nationally. And of course, the Democratic Party in Wisconsin is working with a lot of the folks who were opposed to Walker, and particularly some of the labor unions to get out the vote and also to advocate for Democratic candidates, both Hillary Clinton and otherwise, on the ballot.
And Lily, just a couple of seconds left here, but as you said, a lot of ground to cover before November. We're not even in the home stretch.
Right.
Anything you're watching for from Hillary Clinton in the next few months?
Well, you know, it's also this sort of ground game in terms of where is she going, where are her surrogates going, how are they advertising, where are they advertising? They've got big advertising buys that are going on in a number of states, and Donald Trump has just sort of bought a big advertising buy as well. And so it's both watching Clinton's campaign and also the Trump campaign. And, of course, the debates are yet to come.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on again.
That was Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University, talking about what Hillary Clinton would need to do to win Wisconsin in the presidential race come November. Last week, we talked about Donald Trump.